Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 8th Canto, Chapter 7. We're actually up to text 34. Is 34 on the board or is 35? Okay, so I'll just chant 34. Well, then we'll chant 35 together. Tatashyate sarasato parata parasya nanja swarupa gamane prabhavanti bhumna brahma daya kim uta samstavane vayam tu tat sarga sarga vishaya api shakti matram. Translation. Even personalities like Lord Brahma and other demigods cannot understand your position, for you are beyond the moving and the unmoving creation. Since no one can understand you in truth, how can one offer prayers? How can one offer you prayers? It is impossible. As far as we are concerned, we are creatures of Lord Brahma's creation. Under the circumstances, therefore, we cannot offer you adequate prayers. But as far as our ability allows, we have expressed our feelings. So this is the demigods, the Prajapatis, continuing to speak here, offering prayers to Lord Shiva. Okay, so today's verse. Etat param prapasyamo. Etat param prapasyamo. Na param te Maheshvara. Na param te Maheshvara. Mridanaya hi lokasya. Mridanaya hi lokasya. Vyaktiste vyakta karmana. Vyaktiste vyakta karmana. Etat param prapasyamo. Na param te Maheshvara. Mridanaya hi lokasya. Vyaktiste vyakta karmana. Vaishnavis.
Thank you.
Etat, all these things. Param, transcendental. Prapashyama, we can see. Na, not. Param, the actual transcendental position. Te, of your lordship. Maha Ishvara, O great ruler. Mridanaya, for the happiness. He, indeed. Lokasya, of all the world. Vyakti, manifested. Te, of your lordship. Avyakta Karmana, whose activities are unknown to everyone. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. O greatest of all rulers, your actual identity is impossible for us to understand. As far as we can see, your presence brings flourishing happiness to everyone. Beyond this, no one can appreciate your activities. We can see this much and nothing more. Purport. When the demigods offered these prayers to Lord Shiva, their inner purpose was to please him so that he would rectify the disturbing situation created by the halahala poison. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, text 20, Kamaistaistai Ritigyana Papajante Niyadevataha. When one worships the demigods, when one worships demigods, this is certainly because of deep-rooted desires he wants fulfilled by the mercy of those demigods. People are generally attached to the worship of demigods for some motive. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tenamane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gaudavani Pacharine Nevishesha Sunyavadi Pastachari Shatane. So these demigods are offering prayers to Lord Shiva. They're worshipping Lord Shiva in hopes that he will, as Prabhupada uses, rectify the disturbing situation created by the halahala poison. So what's wrong with that? What's wrong with worshipping the demigods? I mean, if you can get some benefit from worshipping the demigods, why not? Somebody who's been a devotee 5 years or less can answer that question. That's okay. If you've been a devotee 5 years or less and you know the answer to that question, please raise your hand. Okay. Buck the storm. Yeah. And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with indirectly worshiping Krishna? Yeah, so keep going. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with getting some material gains? There, you got it. You got it. Big hand for Bach the Storm. Very good. Yeah. So Krishna says a few verses after this one, Antavatupalam te sham tad babati alpamedasam. Devan devo yajo yanti mad bhaktim yantimam api. Those who have small intelligence, tadbhavati apamedasam, those with small intelligence, they worship the demigods, and their fruits are limited and temporary. And then he goes on to say what you said. Those who worship the demigods, they go to the demigods. But those who worship me come to me. See, so in other words, if you worship the demigods, you'll get a lot of, if you do it properly, you'll get what you want. It's part of, there's a verse, I think the verse before that, it says, Sataya Shraya Yuktas Tasharadhanam Iyati Labate Chatata Kaman Mayaiva Vihitan Itan. That Krishna explains that actually when somebody desires to worship the demigods, he's as the super soul within everyone's heart, he makes that person's faith strong so that they can dedicate themselves to that some particular deity. That's the verse before that. And then he says, endowed with such faith, they devote themselves to some particular deity and they obtain their desires. But Krishna explains also that in actuality, these benefits are bestowed by me alone. So in other words, you get the benedictions you desire, but
as a result of that, you're going to stay here in the material world. You're not going to get free from the cycle of birth or death, which is actually, as you pointed out, the purpose of the whole thing. Human form of life is an opportunity to get free from the cycle of birth and death. If you worship the demigods, you might get what you desire if you do it properly, but the end result will be you'll stay here in the cycle of birth and death, so it's not a good idea. And Krishna goes on, I think it's in the next verse, 24, he says, he explains that this worshipping of the demigods is, is as a result of a misunderstanding of yakta vyaktam apanam manyate mama buddhaya param bhavam ajananto manushanam. How's it go? Mamabhyanam. Yeah. That unintelligent people, they think that I've assumed this form and personality. And that's why they don't understand how Krishna is supreme and that the demigods are subordinate to him. So it's based on a misunderstanding. And the end result is that you don't get Krishna's mercy, the real mercy, which is, the spirit devotional service. You just wind up with some temporary material benefit and then having to take birth again in the material world. So we don't want to do that. But what about the gopis? What about the gopis? Didn't they worship Lord Shiva? So let's take same thing, five years or less. What's the answer to that question? The gopis, if you read the Krishna book, right, the gopis worship Lord Shiva, Kachiyana Vrata, right? Either they worshipped his wife or they worshipped him. I can't remember which, or maybe both. But they worshipped. And the gopis are considered the topmost devotees of Krishna. So what's going on there? The topmost devotees of Krishna, and they're worshipping a demigod, or demigods. What's going on there? Anybody else besides Bach the Storm? It looks like Bach the Storm is reading these books. Any other devotees? 5 years or less? Okay, all right. Well, Bach the Storm. Yeah, he's got it there. The second part of the answer was the exact. Yeah, it's a cultural thing that girls would worship. Did they worship Lord Shiva? Did they worship his wife? It's called Kachiyani Vrata, so. I watch this one. Okay. So it is a cultural thing. But the thing is, why it's not condemned in the case of the gopis is they were worshipping to get Krishna as their husband. So that's considered okay. So, Bach the Storm. And elsewhere, you can appreciate the demigods. It's not like it's, totally taboo. I mean, Prabhupada, I can't remember where he explains it, but he explains that if like in the Brahma Samhita, there's verses in glorification of the different demigods, Surya, Brahma, Shiva, Ganesh, Parvati, like that. It's about five or six of them like that. But that glorification is being expressed in relation to Krishna. And it's presenting things in the proper perspective. So if you glorify, and there's no material benediction being, requested there at the end of the whole glorification. It's not, give me this, give me that. So if you worship the demigods like that, that's also bona fide. So zooming out here a little bit from today's verse, zooming out to just look at the chapter, what's going on here is that the demigods are offering these prayers to Lord Shiva and in hopes of getting a benediction. Basically, they just wanted to save their lives, more or less, because they're afraid that this poison is going to finish them off. And they're requesting Lord Shiva to do something about it. And it's already been kind of discussed in a lot of the previous classes about, why is it that they went to Lord Shiva when Lord Vishnu was right there? He was there as Ajita. He actually was Ajita, Lord Vishnu in his form as Ajita, who brought forth that poison. He, remember, he was using Vasuki as to churn the Mandara Mountain, and as a result, the Halahala poison came out. Why didn't they just go to Ajita, who was Lord Vishnu himself? Oh, maybe they didn't know. But anyway, Prabhupada says in one purport, they didn't know who, the real identity of Ajita, but Prabhupada says in the purport, the idea was that Let me see. I'll try to say it in Prabhupada's own words here. Oh, yeah. In order to give credit to Lord Shiva. That was, the underlying purpose of this pastime is attempt to give credit to Lord Shiva. And then it's also a lot, there's already been a lot of discussion about, well, what is the position of Lord Shiva? And Ramapada Maharaj gave a nice class, very analyzing the whole thing, you know, talking about the Rudras and Mahadev and Sadashiva and, you know, what is the proper, you know, understanding. So we won't go into that. But basically here, as I said, the demigods, they're hoping to get some benediction from Lord Shiva. And it looks like Lord Shiva's, if we read tomorrow's text, which has no purport, so I'll just read that. It says, Sukadeva Goswami continued, Lord Shiva has always benevolent towards all living entities. When he saw that the living entities were very much disturbed by the poison, which was spreading everywhere, he was very compassionate. And thus he spoke to his eternal consort Sati as follows. He says, my dear Bhavani, just see how all these living entities have been placed in danger because of the poison produced from the churning of the ocean of milk. It is my duty to give protection and safety to all living entities struggling for existence. Certainly it is the duty of the master to protect his suffering dependents. So it sounds like Lord Shiva is inclined to help them. And one might ask, well, why exactly? I mean, why is he helping them? We just heard that if the people worship the demigods for material benedictions and they get them, it's just going to make them more attached to the demigod worship. But the result of that is they just stay here in the material world. So why is Lord Shiva going to help them? It's not like they're asking for some, you know, spiritual knowledge or something. They're asking Lord Shiva to save them, to rescue them, you know, prevent them from being finished off. Well, I thought about it, and this is the best I was able to come up with that. And the demigods are devotees. You know, there's Sakama and Akama. So the demigods are Sakama Bhaktas. They're devotees, but they have material desires. And so I think it's that, you know, Lord Shiva, Lord Vishnu as well, you know, helps the demigods out a lot of times in certain situations. Because they are devotees, you know, they're prepared to work with them. It's just like, to give an example, just like in a school, you got a lot of kids and you got the teacher, especially unless, you know, say it's like a grade school or something like that. So the teacher knows way more than the students, you know, way more. I mean, the teacher's teaching mathematics and those, but the teacher has to work with these kids. You know, it's not like the teacher's able to give them the best of his knowledge because they're not capable of assimilating it. If you know, say the teacher, a fifth grade math teacher, he might have a PhD in mathematics, but when he goes into that fifth grade mathematics class, he's got to teach those kids, you know, arithmetic, which is like, for him, it's nothing. But for those kids, that's where they're at. That's what they need to be taught, arithmetic. And the idea is if he teaches them well, you know, they'll learn that, they'll be inspired, and they'll go on, and they'll progress, and eventually someday they'll, you know, get to the higher levels. So I think it's the same thing that, you know, Lord Shiva, Lord Vishnu on occasion, even Lord Brahma, who's, you know, way more elevated than your average demigods, they have to work with these demigods. This is where they're at the moment. They just, you know, but the idea is that, we'll help them with this, and then, you know, we're going to gradually bring them along. They're Sakama devotees, and the idea is to try to help them progress towards Akama devotees. And this is part of that process. That's the, you know, best, as I said, the best answer I was able to come up with. But perhaps a more important point, though, or another point, is that, you know, whereas the demigods are approaching Shiva for the fulfillment of some motive, Prabhupada uses the word demigods, they worship the people in general are attached to worship of the demigods for some motive, meaning material motive, and certainly that's the case here. They wanted their lives saved. Lord Shiva was not doing what he was doing for any material motive. And he had nothing material to gain by drinking an ocean of poison. He was doing it, and he explains his reason in the upcoming verse here. He says, he's talking to his wife still, when one performs benevolent activities for others, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, is very pleased. So that was his, and when the Lord is pleased, I am also pleased. So he was basically just doing it because he wanted to please Hari at the end. We'll take questions and comments at the end. Thanks. That'll leave time. He was doing it because he wanted to please Lord Hari or Vishnu Krishna. And and also being a great devotee, he was feeling compassionate. A little further on, Sukadeva Goswami says, in relation to this whole incident, he says, it is said that great personalities almost always accept voluntary suffering because of the suffering of people in general. This is considered the highest method of worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is present in everyone's heart. So Lord Shiva certainly would have been well aware of this, you know, fully aware of this. So he just saw it as an opportunity to really, you know, do something to really please Vishnu or Krishna, and he was happy to do it. And so that's really important. So, you know, Lord Shiva is sometimes referred to as Vaishnavanam Yata Shambhu, the topmost Vaishnav. So this is like a preaching chapter in one sense, because we should follow in the footsteps of Lord Shiva. You could see that, well, Lord Shiva, he voluntarily, of course, his wife didn't try to stop him. You know, when he made the decision to drink the ocean of poison, Bhavani didn't try to stop him because she knew how, and that's explained here, she knew how powerful he was and she knew he could do it, you know, and it wouldn't have like a real detrimental effect. And sure enough, it didn't. Although he did get a blue line, you know, he actually, it was a whole ocean of poison, and by his mystic powers, he actually concentrated it. He kind of drew it in and concentrated it into what he could fit in the palm of his hand. A little bit of that spilled, and that's where the scorpions and all these poisonous insects and stuff like that get their poison from. It's extraordinary. But anyway, Lord Shiva drank that, and you know, he got a blue line in his throat. And that's the name Nilakanta. But, you know, basically, he knew he could handle it. But it was, it doesn't sound like it was like fun and games, but he did it. So, once again, we have to understand the principle here, which is that we have to, as Vaishnavas, we have to accept voluntary suffering because of the suffering of people in general. That's the underlying principle of preaching. So, I mean, in one sense, Lord Shiva is preaching. He's helping the demigods come to a higher level of spiritual understanding. It's going to be a long road, but it's part of that. And same way, we have to, you know, we have to try to do that. It's part of being a devotee. I mean, of course, you could not do that, but if somebody is not willing to do that, there's different levels of devotees. Of course, there's, you know, Kanishtadikari, Majjhimadikari, and Uttamadikari. And if you want to come to the Majjhimadikari level, you have to be, you know, prepared to try to understand four different principles, which one is that you worship the Supreme Lord, you avoid the envious, you make friends with the devotees, and you try to enlighten the innocent. That's part of being a Majjhimadikari. So, you know, means this, means you, and to do that, to enlighten the innocent, you got to voluntarily accept suffering, because that's just the nature of the thing. It's going to be inconvenient. It's going to be, I mean, when you're young, there's different problems that present themselves to a young, the mind and body of a young devotee, and then when you're older, there's a different set of difficulties that present themselves to the body and the mind of an older devotee. But in either case, you have to just make that decision that, okay, I got to voluntarily accept these difficulties and try to, you know, reach out and give people this knowledge. And it's, you know, a very important part of advancing in Krishna consciousness. And I think actually it's said here in this, if I'm not remember correctly, yeah, Prabhupada says here in the purport, he says, here's an explanation of how those engaged in activities for the welfare of others are very quickly recognized by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And it goes on to explain that this is the best way of worshiping, you know, the best form of worship to try to do like this. So, I mean, it's if you stop, I mean, that's our objective, right? We want to be recognized by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Prabhupada's saying here, this is a way to be not just recognized, not just quickly recognized, but very quickly recognized by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it might be difficult, but it's in our interest. And that's the name of the game. You know, I mean, the tapasya. Tapasya means voluntarily accepting some inconvenience to the mind and body for the purpose of making spiritual advancement. So that's what, you know, spiritual life is all about. And here is this very specific type of tapasya that's being, you know, explained here, described here, that is like going into the fast lane. If you accept this tapasya, in the words of Srila Prabhupada, you're going to be very quickly recognized by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it's important, you know, and for those devotees who are, you know, serious about advancing in devotional service, everybody should try to figure out a way how they can do like this, you know. And another thing that kind of came to my mind when I was reflecting upon this is this point of preaching and tapasya. Oh, yeah, and I was making the point that a certain set of difficulties presents themselves to the mind and body of a young devotee, and then there's a different set that presents to an older person. So as you get older, there's a natural tendency to want to be comfortable, you know, and it's really all the Prabhupada disciples who are still trying to preach. With every additional year, you appreciate Srila Prabhupada more, because Prabhupada was preaching, he was attempting to preach, even when he was in India, you know, from his late 50s onwards, but at 70, Prabhupada, in not really great health, obviously, because he had two heart attacks on the boat going over, with no money, with no contacts, basically with nothing, Prabhupada just went out, set sail, and, you know, came here to the United States to preach. And, that must have been really... Prabhupada is the prime example of accepting voluntary suffering because of the suffering of people in general. Nobody's a better example of that than Srila Prabhupada. And it's something, once again, it's something that we have to do. We can't be complacent. Somebody might think, these people are suffering out there, but they deserve it. That's their karma. You know, many years ago, one devotee wrote a little pamphlet, The Myth of the Innocent Victim. The Myth of the Innocent Citizen. The devotee is pointing out that there's no such thing as an innocent victim. Everybody's just, you know, getting their karma. They're getting what they deserve. So why should we be so worried about the fact that they're suffering? They're getting what they deserve. Well, two points on that. One is, what if Prabhupada was thinking like that? What if Prabhupada was thinking, why do I have to go at 70 years old, go all the way across this ocean and, you know, go to this place that I don't know anything about with no money and no connections, and I'll stay here in Vrindavan? Well, where would we be, you see? Prabhupada understood that, okay, he had to be compassionate. And just to give an example, just like imagine just hypothetical situation, you're walking down the street and, you're walking down the street and you see a police car and there's a policeman sitting in the car. And then you walk around the corner, you turn the corner, and you're walking a little further, and you see some young person, you know, maybe 7-8 years old, kind of walking down the street. And before you see that, you're walking, you turn the corner, you see there's a bunch of like rubble on the street there, you know, maybe with, I don't know what it's from, some parts from a car or something like that, just on the sidewalk. And you walk a little further, and you see this kid 7 or 8 years old. And then you see something looks kind of weird to you. You see like an older person, you know, an adult, and they're kind of closing in on that kid, and that person looks really kind of questionable. And you see the person kind of gets right up on the kid, and the kid's totally freaked out. And, you can see the expression on the kid's face. They're totally freaked out, and they start, you know, crying out for help. And that guy is trying to get the kid into a car. And you don't know, you can't see whether there's somebody else in the car or not, but what are you going to do? Are you just going to, like, think, well, anyway, that's that kid's karma, what can I do? I hope I wouldn't think like that. You follow what I'm saying? It's kind of like, you know, you could just go, well, that's that kid's karma, just walk along and mind your own business. But I'm hoping that what I would do and what everybody would do, at least all the men, would be just, you know, grab a lead pipe off the street, you know, as I said, you know, just take it and whack the guy in the back of the head, you know, and then grab the kid and run around the corner and to the police car, something like, you know, you have to do that. In other words, there's karma and there's dharma. It's true that everybody's getting their karma. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, there's dharma. And our dharma is that, despite the fact that it is their karma that they're, you know, meant to suffer like this, it's our dharma that we have to try to help them. See? And of course, that involves, you know, voluntary accepting suffering. And even if we don't feel compassionate, we have to try to just, with using our intelligence, got to do it. And you know, making use of those two understandings, that one, that it's even if we don't feel the compassion, just remind yourself, it's, hey, I'll do it for a selfish reason. I'll do it just because it's such a pleasing thing to my spiritual master and such a pleasing thing to Krishna. I'm going to make so much, you know, spiritual advance by doing this. Let me do it. You see, you know, it's a decision. You know, actually, in the initial stages, compassion is a decision more than it is a feeling. As you get purified, because, you know, the soul by nature, like Lord Shiva, I bet you he was actually feeling compassion. You know, I don't think for him it was just like an intellectual thing. Well, yeah, these demigods are kind of the Sakama devotees, and I suppose I should help them. No, he felt it, because he's, you know, Vaishnavanam Chittasambhu. He's the topmost Vaishnava. And Prabhupada felt it. But maybe in the, you know, the earlier stages of devotional service, we might not feel it. Like, sometimes I don't feel it, but we have to use our intelligence and try to understand what's what I should do and do it. And as we do it, as we get purified, then eventually, hopefully, we'll start actually feeling it. And it's like that for everything in Krishna consciousness. You know, I think there's one purport in the Bhagavad Gita where Prabhupada says you have to act in the status of spirit soul. You know, you might not feel like a spirit soul, but you have to act like in the status of spirit soul. It means, you know, get up early in the morning, come to Mangalarati, follow the regular principles, chant Hare Krishna, and then you get the realization. So first, you know, intelligence has to do it on the strength of the intelligence, and then the feeling will be there. And we should try to do it with enthusiasm. As we saw, once again, we saw Srila Prabhupada do it. Prabhupada didn't just drag his heels. You know, Prabhupada was enthusiastic. I mean, Prabhupada's mood was, it's actually still like inconceivable to devotees today. When you hear Prabhupada preach on his, you know, classes and his walks, his idea was, I want to turn this world upside down. His mood was like that. And why? Because if you take something, let's take this glass. Is there anything in it? It has water in it, so I won't do it. But if you took that glass and turned it upside down, okay? Let's forget about the glass. Let's use a pencil, okay? Let's say you turn it upside down, and then if you have something that starts off, to start off with, is upside down, and you turn it upside down again, then what do you got? It's upside right now. So that was why Prabhupada was had that mood to turn the world upside down, because he could understand. He said, this entire world is topsy-turvy. It's already upside down. And if we turn it upside down again, then they'll be first seeing things in the right way. Like generally, you know, once you leave this room here and you go out there, 99.9% of the people there are thinking that consciousness, that's just a derivative of matter. That's just something that comes about. You know, consciousness comes about a certain stage of evolution when by evolution, the temporal, you know, the cerebral cortex or something like that developed to a certain stage, and the consciousness came about, and here we are thinking about everything. But, I mean, from our understanding, they have it exactly topsy-turvy. It's the other way around. You know, matter, consciousness doesn't come from matter. The other way around. Matter comes from consciousness. But the general mass of people don't have a clue. You know, they don't have a clue. And actually, we're like sitting on a, and sometimes we forget ourselves, you know, what our situation is. We're sitting on a gold mine of knowledge. You know, you've heard that expression, sitting on a gold mine? Well, we're sitting on a gold mine of knowledge. There used to be this show on television, The Beverly Hillbillies. I don't know if you remember who goes back that far, you know. But they were just these people, yeah, West Virginia, and they had oil on their property. They didn't know. They didn't know they had oil on their property, and they didn't know what it was worth. You know, and somebody come along and explained it to them anyway. So sometimes we're a little like that, you know, like the Beverly Hillbillies. We're sitting here. We have this knowledge. It's the highest knowledge. And, you know, we're just thinking, oh yeah, so we got. But this is like such a valuable thing. And it's, you know, the vast majority of people out there, they don't have a clue, you know, they're totally bewildered. But actually, I'll just read one little thing. Some of the karmis who are kind of like a little bit more clever or you know, smart, They know what's going on. This is a quote from a very famous scientist, Max Planck, who's considered one of the founders of the quantum theory. And he goes, "I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as a derivative from consciousness. We cannot get behind consciousness." You see? So, in other words, the topmost guys, the topmost intelligent scientists, they understand. At least they don't understand Krishna, but they understand about that consciousness is where it's at, not matter. You know, that matter is not the fundamental, principle of everything, but consciousness is. But that hasn't filtered down to the rank and file among science, from what I can understand. And it's certainly not, known by the general mass of people. So, it's once again, it's our responsibility. We've got to get out there and, tell them what we know. There'll be people out there who will appreciate it. And more than anything else, Krishna will appreciate it. If we make that attempt, if we make the attempt to do like what Prabhupada said, get out there, confront them, give them, life comes from life. Life doesn't come from matter. Then just by that effort to do that, our Prabhupada will be pleased, Krishna will be pleased, and they will inspire these people from within to, pay more attention and take us more seriously. Ultimately, preaching success is dependent upon whether the spiritual master and Krishna are pleased, not the general populace. So if we just, try to be very bold and enthusiastic in our preaching, like Prabhupada was, then Prabhupada and Lord Chaitanya and Krishna will be pleased, and amazing things could happen. And one last point was that, and of course we're doing that already to a certain extent. And I think it's important that that as like a community of devotees, we kind of work as a team, and we have to encourage, we have to encourage the devotees who are kind of like doing that, we should try to encourage devotees who are trying to preach in any way, and particularly devotees who are trying to preach along those lines, because everybody needs encouragement. And even Prabhupada said there was a situation where the devotees were way behind on printing the books. Prabhupada had already translated a lot, and they were back. They owed him so many books. And once again, I can't remember the exact words, but Prabhupada made a comment to the effect that, come on, if you guys don't keep up with me and print the books as I translate them, then I'm not encouraged to write it. He said, even I need encouragement. Now, I don't know if he's just saying that for our benefit or if he really felt like that or what, but anyway, he said it. The lesson's there for us. Certainly ordinary souls need encouragement. I think when you're on the topmost platform, there's a verse in the Bhagavatam, Vayam tu navatripyama yach uttama shloka vikrame yach shrinvatam rasagyanam swadu swadu pade pade. So when you're on that platform, maybe then you don't need encouragement. When you're actually experiencing swadu, swadu, pade, pade, that at every step it's just getting more and more nectar, more and more sweet. You're just relishing the nectar of the transcendental sound vibration when you're chanting, when you're quoting shlokas. Okay, maybe then you don't need encouragement. But if you're not on that platform, you need encouragement, So it's important. We've got to encourage the people who are, the devotees who are, working along those lines because, anyway, I think, Prabhupada would want that. That's a very important part. So I'll stop there, 8:15, and I'll, Archita Prabhu.
It's about the tapasya aspect. Because sometimes it seems when we preach that point that we're encouraging people who have to give away what they have and then preach. But that's not really what the Shastra is saying. For instance, I'll give you a statement Prabhupada made in the preface of the Nectar of Devotion. He said, one may live a life without discomfiture, but one must try to love Krishna. So it's not that if you're comfortable, you should try to be uncomfortable. That's not the point. The point is, whatever you have, you should use in Krishna service. And Prabhupada is the best example of that. When he had nothing, he was preaching. When he had everything, he was preaching even more. So it's not that, he kept himself in a position of not having anything. No. When Krishna sent more and more and more, he preached more and more and more. So wherever you are, whatever you have, use it in Krishna service. If you're a rich man, and this is a mistake that we've been making in this country for many years, at least I still see it happening, that we have become expert at preaching to the masses, but we don't know how to preach to class. We actually scare the classy people away. So it's not that if you're a high-class person and you have everything that you have to become poor. No, that's not our path. Some people preach that. That, you know, they're very impressed when somebody gives everything up and becomes poor and they think they're spiritual in that way. No. So real spirituality is use what you have in Krishna service. So if you're a rich man, use everything you have. You don't have to become uncomfortable. Yeah, even in our case, Prabhupada said in Mayapur, he was speaking to a local gentleman. This is in the conversation series. He said, why am I building this Mayapur project? And the man couldn't answer. He said, we're Indians. We can pass our obnoxious anywhere. But he said, I'm building it for my Western disciples so they can come here and comfortably sit down and worship Lord Chaitanya. So comfort is necessity, especially in the beginning. People are not so attracted to a movement where they have to come and be uncomfortable. They want to be comfortable. That's natural. But try to love Krishna. That's the point. And use everything that you have in Krishna's service.
Yep, thank you. Nice clarification. Anybody else have anything? Mata, up here. I think. Okay.
Thank you, Prabhu, for the encouraging class. Specifically about compassion, I was thinking about how Prabhupada mentioned that we have to deliver this heavy truth that so many people are not ready to hear, or they're not very receptive. But how do we deliver this knowledge with compassion without lessening the importance of or the stress of this truth, you know, so that they can receive it?
Give them a book. I'm not sure I'm 100% clear on your question, but you can. Everybody has to preach according to their capacity. So, you know, in the process of giving people heavy truth, you don't want to alienate them, if that's what you're kind of touching upon. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I think, gave the instruction that you have to humble persuasion. So sometimes you're not going to be able to directly tell people, you know, the heavy truth. But if somehow or another you can manage to get them, just get them to like you enough so that they'll take a book and give a donation, then they'll get the heavy truth when they read the book. So that's a way you could kind of, you know, achieve both things. You can give them the heavy truth, but without kind of getting them defensive. Does that kind of answer your question? Don't you? Okay, thank you. Oh, it's Vasprabhu.
Yeah, I remember when I was distributing books, we were always concerned about this thing about compassion. And I recall that, I'm not quite sure how it came about it, but there were devotees in those days to say that we can't understand compassion because all of us are very interested in bodily platform of life. We want something, an exchange for what we do. So it's very hard to have this genuine compassion. But it was said in those days that compassion can be exhibited by following the instruction and 100% being surrendered to the instruction of the spiritual master. Srila Prabhupada knew compassion. And if we fully surrender to his instruction, that is compassion to the fallen conditioned souls. Because Prabhupada knows what it is. We don't know, really. But if we follow that instruction, in due course of time, we'll understand real compassion.
Yeah, I was trying to make that point. I don't know if maybe it didn't come across. But, yeah, when you hear the word compassion, you think of a feeling.
Yeah.
And initially, it may or may not be there. Most likely, it's not going to be there in the early stages of devotional service, because that's a feeling, that's a spiritual feeling that you experience when you become advanced in spiritual life.
Yes.
But, you know, for somebody
this
who's
word
advanced,
compassion is not a mundane word when we deal with it on a spiritual platform.
Right. But as you said, if we just strictly follow the instructions of Prabhupada, then that's we're acting compassionately. Even if we're not feeling
that's right.
The feeling, but we're acting compassionately by following the instructions of Prabhupada in general and preaching in particular. Last question. This gentleman had his hand up during the class, so we'll give him a last question and then we'll end. Okay. Grandjoy Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.
What happened to that cotton?
I am the cotton. You changed.